This idea of people will take you at whatever you present yourself to be. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to present yourself to be the thing that everybody else is presenting themselves to be. Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 163 of Art Juice. This is honest, generous, and humorous conversations to feed your creative soul and get you thinking with me, Louise Fletcher.
And me, Alice Sheridan.
And this week, we're going to tackle the topic of counterintuitive thinking. I'm not sure if that will end up being the title of this podcast, but that's basically what we're going to talk about. And we're going to be chatting about a book that we've both read and that Alice remembers more of than I do. So, but I'm sure she'll prompt my memory as we go on. But before we get on to that main topic, what have you been up to this week, Alice?
Been pretty fast week again. I have been finishing off frames, waxing frames. I did some samples, enjoyed the lovely Easter sunshine that we had to get those finished, and had quite an interesting kind of conversation about, you know, whether you like doing that part of the process or not. I know what you're done when you're finished with the painting, you're like, done, all over it. I quite like this finishing off part. And, you know, sometimes, and I always say the first thing that you should outsource is your framing. But perhaps having done that for a while, I'm actually finding that I quite enjoy doing it myself. And I think this is a little bit different because although the frames are all the same, I want to have different finishes. So I've actually got to decide, drop the paintings in, say, yeah, this is going to be dark or light or mid, you know, so I need to know which one's which, do them myself, really. So I'm finishing that off, ready to take down to the gallery for when this comes out next Friday. So, yeah.
It's exciting.
It is exciting.
Are you pleased with how they look?
Yes, I'm really pleased. So the gallery has, you know, basically they wanted big ones. So I did big ones, but I'm really pleased that the introduction of having something slightly smaller has given a change of rhythm. So I hope that they'll show some of those as well. And some will be through them and some will be on my website because there isn't space for everything there. So yeah, I'm just the bit that I don't enjoy is all the photographs, naming files, downgrading them, uploading to website. I've got all that to come.
Yeah, that's people don't understand. I had Scarlett help me with that. She's finished her work experience now, but when she was here, she put the paintings for the next series on the website on Hidden Pages. And she commented on, people don't understand how much there is to do after you finish the paintings.
And so much.
Yeah. And even though she's done that, I've still got to write something about each one because that's important to me, that I have something individual about each painting. So I've got all that to do. I actually had a visit from the gallery manager coming to see the paintings. They've been really involved, which is interesting, throughout the process. So they came first to have a studio visit and talk about the show. Then we've talked about how it's going to be presented over email. And then they wanted to come back and see the paintings. And when I say they, the gallery is managed by somebody, but she has a team of volunteers who help with the hanging and all of that stuff. And the main volunteer was with her last time and he was with her again. And I had this thing, which I always have, where you think, oh no, they're going to hate it all. Like I got it all out and I had to put it in two spaces for them, be enough room for them to see everything. And I thought they're just going to hate it. And then what am I going to do? I'm going to see their faces fall and they'll have to be polite because it's only a month until the exhibition and there's nothing they can do. And it wasn't like that at all. It was really nice. Their reaction was genuinely really positive and excited. And the guy who does the hanging was like, oh, I can see it now. I've got my vision. And they told me how they wanted, they do it a little bit differently than I would normally do. So they wanted a specific way that the D-rings will go on the back and everything, which is fine. And so we had that. So that visit went well. So I felt good about that. But of course, it left me with jobs at the end. So I've said that I want text throughout the exhibition. I want there to be little cards that you can read as you walk around. And because of where it is, it's a tourist information center with a cafe, Mm-hmm. And then the tourist information part, and then this gallery. So they have their regular collectors. I'll have my people go in, but then they also have people who just wander in and don't necessarily understand art. And they said it's a very mixed bag of the people that just wander in. So I'd like to be able to help people understand or get a feeling of what they're looking at. I really like doing that when I hang my work. So that's all to be written now. So when they left, somehow it's like everything. When they leave, you still have a list of things that you have to do.
That thing we've mentioned before as well, when you tick something off your to-do list, like it's gone out and then it comes back at you again. And I'm like, I just did that.
And you mentioned on your Instagram about a studio assistant. And the difference with making my art versus doing my course, which now we're on the fourth year, I've got the same marketing person I've had for 4 years. I've got the same assistant that I've had for 3 years. And they're just cranking out everything that needs to happen. And so we've got 4 years of marketing data, so we know which ads work best, so we can just run those again or do slightly modified versions. Jamie, my assistant, is setting up all of the lessons and getting all of that side of it done, scheduling the coaches, because she knows I've got a lot on and she's taking a lot of that on. And I think, oh, wow, there's a real difference in the pleasure of doing the bits you like and that you're good at, and letting other people do the things they're good at. And I am not good at varnishing. I think you like framing and things because you're good at it. I'm not good at it. I balls it up and it's annoying and I get frustrated. So I just I'd love to find someone to do that, but I don't make enough work to make it worthwhile. So
that's the thing, isn't it? And I think I remember right at the beginning being really frustrated by everybody, like the stage that you're at with your business and the courses and everything, you know, a little bit like we touched on last week, it's taken a while to get there and you have to kind of step through some of the mud a bit to get to that stage for definite.
Yes.
And, you know, take big jumps and make decisions that feel risky at the time, and you don't always know what's going to work out, but also you understand it. And I think that's what always really bothered me about that kind of advice early on. Oh, outsource. You've got to know what it is. You've got to know what you want. You've got to know what it is. You have to understand how it fits in. And there's no shortcut to that bit.
No, outsourcing has taken me a long time. And
and
the danger of outsourcing, even when it's like now, like I say, we know what we're doing. So it's very different than when we started, when it was all new. And Jamie says to me, I don't know how you did all this, because I'm struggling to keep up with it. And you've got to also do the presenting and develop the content and create everything.
I know how you did it. You felt really passionate about doing it. And I think that's a lot behind what we do as artists as well. I mean, I remember way back at the beginning when I was building, you know, come out of, so I had some design sense, but building website and things, and Paul saying to me, you know, you're spending, so why are you doing this? I was like, because I feel really strongly that this needs to be part of my life. That's why we do it. You know, that's the driver. You can't sustain that kind of thing forever, but you have to feel it to begin with. And actually, if you don't do things, it's probably because you don't feel that strong about them. I mean, we do things that we not always enjoy, but we know have meaning for us, don't we?
Yeah. And I think the other thing, as you're talking, I'm thinking the other big key is I didn't try and make it perfect. So I did what Seth Godin calls minimum viable product, which sounds really corporate-y, but meaning do the minimum, do it as well as you can, but don't try and make it this big, all shiny bells and whistles thing at the beginning. Because if you do, what happens is you've got it all wrong anyway the first time you do it. You have to redo it and refine it and improve it. If it's a course, for example. So you can't go launching it with, if you get a videographer and you spend all this money and you get all the lights and everything, and then you realize, oh, module 3 doesn't work and module 5 needs to change, and that people didn't get that part. So just doing it initially for a lower price and doing it not very, well, I wouldn't say not very well, but not knowing what I'm doing and learning as I go. And then now we make improvements every year, but we can do that because now there's a team of people, whereas initially it was just me and I had to do it minimally.
Yeah, and I think also then when you make improvements, it fits in, it sinks in, doesn't it? And we see this with people, you know, all sorts of artists. You know, many of you listening will be knowing this because you run workshops. Think back to the first one that you did. You know, you didn't really know what kit to take, who was going to come along, how to talk to people, how long things were going to take them, what they needed to know from you, what they didn't, all of those kind of things. And I think, you know, so often we see it, people say, what tends to happen though is people, and me included, lots of us, you sit and worry about what all the things, and then something happens that prompts you into saying yes, or suddenly you've got a date in the diary, or someone has asked and they've caught you on a good day, and then you're like, oh holy smoke, now I've really got to do it.
Yeah.
and then you're up against it deadline timing wise, you've got no choice but to do it just the best you can in the time you've got available.
Yeah. But when you think about how you started Connected Artist, you said, okay, this is the lowest price it will ever be because I haven't got anything yet and I'm going to build it as I go. And it was perfect. We just joined and we had, I don't know, a live call every week or something in a Facebook
chat
group.
We had, you had the visual of a spreadsheet with all the content, and
what I will be doing.
Yeah.
But I'm sure that you've come up with things subsequently that weren't in your initial plan, because as you got the group together, you realize what people needed and then it's easier. So if anybody, I know lots of people struggle with this. If you're thinking about a course or a membership or some other, or going out and doing workshops, don't wait to have the perfect idea. Just do it, and don't charge very much so you don't feel like people are getting ripped off, and then learn from what you've done and then make it better. And anyway,
it's the same with everything, isn't it? It's the same with painting. It's the same with framing. You know, you don't start off by having bespoke £200 frames made.
Yeah.
You know, you start off with what you can get from Homebase and making sure that you cut the mounts nicely and they're as good as they can look, and you charge a price that you feel good at for the work you've done, and you go up from there.
Yeah.
Onwards. That's it.
So this week's chat was inspired by a book that Alice mentioned a few months ago now, and she recommended to me. I listened to it on an audio book, and the book is called, of course, I had it pulled up on my phone, now I have it, Alchemy by Rory Sutherland. And he is I think he's a retired marketing executive from a big ad agency.
Yeah, he was the vice chairman of Ogilvy.
Right. And so had, I presume, with his age generation, probably worked his way up through the ranks of an advertising agency doing all the jobs over the years. And he has this really interesting idea about marketing and about thinking about things differently, counterintuitively, when you come to do your marketing. And I'm sure this is what made him so successful, because when you read the book, it all makes perfect sense. So you brought this idea up, Alice. Do you want to just tell us what you think it's about?
Yeah, I actually think it's broader than marketing. I know that's his background, but I listened to it on audiobook, and I'm not a massive audiobook listener, but he's got a very nice voice to listen to. And then I bought the hard copy as well, which only just opened today to try and find a bit. But I bought the book as well because I thought this is really, I want to be able to see it and mark bits and go back to it. So the subtext of it is the magic of original thinking in a world of mind-numbing conformity. And I think it goes way beyond marketing, actually. It's about how we approach so many things in life, understanding our own weird reasons for doing things, why something is important to us, why we feel drawn to thing A rather than thing B, how we value things. It's not just about you know, marketing in terms of what you might want to bring in for other people. I just think in terms of human understanding, it's a really nice, interesting book. So really well worth a read. But the reason that we came back to it today was we had a post and a discussion on the Co-Create call in my membership this week about a post that has been on Twitter with an artist saying, and I didn't see it, I'm not on Twitter anymore, an artist saying, here is a drawing, apparently a very beautiful drawing of a fox, how much would you pay for it? And the answers range from £50 to not a penny less than £500. And the person who brought it up for discussion was saying, it kind of really hit me that the value of what we sell can be anything, really. You know, it's extraordinary. And it is, so much of what we do is about finding the value in it for ourselves and for other people. And like everything, for some people, they'll find value in it and others will be like, pat, not interested. Also having a discussion this week in DMs with an artist on Instagram dealing with one of those, I don't even know how anybody can make this stuff and make money. You know, you should just go away and not bother kind of things, you know.
How sad is that person? Not the person who got the message, the person who left the message.
Yeah. Yeah.
How sad must your life be that you've got to take time to send something nasty to someone else?
Yeah. But again, in amongst a whole load of messages and a very successful account of paintings that people obviously really appreciate.
Yeah.
You can't control it.
Yeah.
You can't control what other people make decisions of.
I used to teach customer service many years ago in another life. And one of the exercises that my boss designed for people who were trying to sell things to customers was that an exercise just like you just described. He would say, he would make these statements and he would ask us all to write down what we thought the answer was. So he would say things like, Alice makes a large salary. How much does Alice make? And then we would all write down the amount. And it would, you know, depending how much you made or your family background or whatever, or Jerry smokes a lot of cigarettes. How many cigarettes does Jerry smoke? 2 a day, 50 a day, you know, and it makes you realize that you go into, now I am talking about marketing, but you go into a selling a painting situation with your own idea of what's expensive. So you say, oh, I can't possibly charge £1,000 for a painting. That's too expensive. But too expensive for who? Too expensive for you, maybe, but not too expensive for the person who would say not a penny less than, you know, £5,000 for that painting.
I had a bit of a block about that at the beginning, because it wasn't that I didn't see the value in it, or I couldn't see that, you know, there were people who would pay that. My worry was that people who would pay larger prices for paintings would expect a lot from, more than I could deliver in terms of customer service, and would be difficult and awkward and demanding. And now, where that came from, somewhere in the past I have been difficult and awkward and demanding and expecting too much of things that I've paid a lot of money for. And why not? You do expect, you know, when you pay more, you expect more. So I think that it does come into where do you deliver on that? But it's a complete circus, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And what's he saying in this book is that, well, there are some shared weirdnesses that all humans have and some individual weirdnesses, but that we don't make our decisions. So your decision not to sell expensive paintings wasn't a rational decision. It was a decision based on your weird psychology. My weird psychology tells me, and I know where I got this from, it's from my dad, that people with money are horrible, snobby, ridiculous, awful people. Like, you don't want anything to do with them. In later life, I know that not to be true, because I've met lots of nice people who have money, but I grew up thinking that. So like you, I would think, you don't want to work for people like that because they're just difficult.
Yeah. So that's why I think it's interesting in terms of what it reflects back to you, not just kind of what you, not just in terms of how you might market. There's some rules that he's got, which I'm not sure if he reads this at the beginning, but certainly in the written version. Let me just go through some of these and we'll just see if any of these trigger thoughts for today. So Rory's rules of alchemy. The opposite of a good idea can also be a good idea. Can't remember what that one was about. Don't design for average. I love that. This was about an airline pilot in a cockpit. So they'd taken, you know, dimensions, height, width, you know, everybody, weight, to design the perfect pilot cockpit that suited average. In reality, nobody is average because everybody has something that makes them a bit taller, a bit wider, their knees are a bit longer. So actually they've designed something that doesn't suit anybody perfectly. It does the best of a kind of average job. But I think for us making art, creating things, average really is the absolute opposite of what we're aiming for. Be weird, be freaky, be wonderful, be different.
One of the, you know? One of the things that I often hear from newer artists is, in my course, everyone's working. Someone will say, I don't want to share this because it's not like anything anyone else has done. Mm. We've got this desire to fit in and be average when we're in a new situation. And I always say, you know, fantastic. If already what you're making is not what everybody else is doing, then you're on the right path. But it is a very much amongst beginner artists, a desire to be average, even though we wouldn't put it in those words.
Yeah. What about this one then? It doesn't pay to be logical if everyone else is being logical.
Yeah. So I assume from that he's saying, if we're selling our paintings and everybody else is selling their paintings based on a certain way, a logical way of marketing themselves, if you were to be completely illogical, it reminds me of a conversation we had with Georgina years ago where she was saying, why can't you charge whatever you want for your paintings? Why do they all have to be done at the size? Everyone 60 by 60 is this price. Why can't you say this one's better than the rest, so I'm going to charge more? And we all said, that's ridiculous. You can't do that. And I spoke to her recently and she still insists that we can. We didn't convince her at all that we can't. She still says, maybe she's got a point. Maybe if you marketed your paintings as I charge what I feel like charging.
Then it comes down to, are we brave enough to try it, doesn't it? So so the normal way of doing it is here are six paintings. They are £500. Up to you. You choose which one you like, which one suits you, which one grabs you, all the things. If I actually said, here are six paintings, three of them are £500, that one's 2,000, they're all the same size, that one's 3,500,
would
that work?
Some people would want the more expensive ones, I bet you.
Yeah, so then it comes down to, am I brave enough to try it? And I can tell you the honest answer is no.
But I wonder if anybody would buy the cheaper ones, because would our natural counterintuitive thinking say that's not a bargain, there must be something wrong with those ones if they're cheap? If she's charging that much for that one, why is this one only £500?
Right, but if you could, if £500 is your budget and that's the one you like, winner, because the painting that I really like is the £500 one, not the £2,500 one. Yeah. Maybe it is a good way of touching people.
So don't.
I'm not brave.
Let's see if anyone who's listening is brave enough to try this out and see if Rory Sutherland is right that it's be illogical in a world of logical people.
I think this is an interesting point there. So this is a nice little story here that he calls Turning Lead into Gold. Value is in the mind and heart of the valuer. I'm just going to read a little bit of it. It says, the reason that the alchemists gave up in the Middle Ages was because they were looking at the problem the wrong way. They had set themselves the impossible task of trying to turn lead into gold, but had got into their heads that the value of something lies solely in what it is. This is a false assumption. You don't need to tinker with atomic structure to make lead as valuable as gold. All you need to do is tinker with human psychology so that it feels as valuable as gold, at which point, who cares that it isn't actually gold? If you think that that's impossible, look at paper money in your wallet or purse. Don't have much anymore. It's all done digitally, doesn't it? Which just shows you it's all a complete, you know, it's just random numbers.
Yeah.
Really.
Look at NFTs. Mm. You just make a rabbit, is it Justin Timberlake? No, who's that other one? Oh, who's that boy pop singer with the Justin Bieber? Bieber. He's not even a boy anymore. He's probably a fully grown man. Justin Bieber released like 900 NFT rabbits, and some of them had some special, like a hat or something. Apparently, the artwork, according to the podcaster I was listening to, the artwork is terrible. I'm not going to say whether it is or not because I haven't seen them. But they were selling for hundreds and hundreds of pounds in Bitcoin. So they were selling for Bitcoin, which doesn't exist, and they don't exist because they're digital art. And if you got the one with the special hat, it's worth way more than all the others.
According to some people, according to me,
yeah, you can sell it. Yeah, you can resell it for a lot more money.
Yeah.
And there's nothing there.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because we were talking about this just before we started. We were talking about if you're not careful, this gets into, rather than just understanding, it gets into manipulation zone. And I think that's where you have to be careful with any of this. And you made a very good point. You said, yeah, but it depends on your, you know, genuine reasons behind it.
Yeah, because all marketing, you could say all marketing's manipulation or has the potential to be manipulative. Yeah. There are certain things I do in the marketing which have been proven to work with people. Doing a free course before you do a paid course, that has been proven as a marketing strategy that works. I think I do that for a good reason. I think that doing a free course first is a good idea because it gives people a chance to see if they like working with you and then decide if they want to go ahead. Whereas without that, they have to plump down the money and trust that they're going to like you. And then if you annoy the hell out of them after 2 weeks, they can't get out of it. So I think it's for good. And because I genuinely love my course and think it changes people's lives, I want you to buy it. I want to do whatever I can to get you to buy it because I know what good it does.
Yeah.
But the same tactics can be used to do something. The same tactics can be used to sell you something that's crap. You can take the free course. You can think, wow, this was fantastic. You can sign up for the full thing and then find out that the host, the main person, isn't really presenting the full course. They're not even there. And you get a bunch of handouts and a few videos and that's it. I haven't experienced this, by the way, so I'm not saying that I have experienced it, but you could use the same thing very manipulatively.
I think these days word would get around pretty quickly.
Yeah, you could only do it once.
That's a fairly short-term strategy then, isn't it? It's not really going to work.
But then I don't know, you see these swindlers, they get away with it over and over and over again as long as they do it once on one person and then move on somewhere else.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just think, but someone else might say, well, she's manipulative because she's doing these marketing things. So I think it's a continuum, isn't it? And everything has the potential to be good or evil. But I genuinely think it depends with marketing, our paintings or our courses. Do we believe they're worth what we're selling them for? Do we love our own work and think someone else should buy it? Think, you know, you should have this. It's fantastic. Look at these paintings Alice has just made. You should buy one. It would look great in your house. I don't think that's manipulation, but I think understanding the way people make decisions is really important, because if you put those paintings up in the gallery and you make them all cheap because you believe that logically that will sell more paintings, I know you wouldn't do this, but logically they will be more appealing. And then you hear someone come into the gallery and say, oh, they've got some low rent artist in here at the moment. Let's leave again, because they're looking for something that has prestige and gives them a sense of their own importance or their own, you know, and they want to spend £10,000 on a painting and these are just beneath them.
Yeah.
When you realize that, then I think understanding that kind of thing helps you to better target your audience and better market what you're doing, and as you say, better understand perhaps people's behavior as well.
Yeah, and it's a growth thing as well. I think that you make that journey, I think, with art, with what you create. I think everybody starts off not charging enough because we have worries about whether it is good enough or not, and honestly at the beginning it probably isn't often, but we get better at it. You know, we underestimate what's gone into it. We feel we can't charge that. We need to have that confidence and start to kind of grow that proof, I think, from the outside as well as internally about what things are valued at. But this is an interesting story. And so this is going to, you know, you'll understand this. He says, All successful businesses, much as they pretend to be popular for rational reasons, owe most of their success to having stumbled on a psychological magic trick. And he talks about Red Bull as being marketed as a drink that is doesn't taste as nice as Coke, is more expensive than Coke, is in a smaller can than Coke. Yeah, great idea. Let's launch this as a product, and it actually works really well.
Don't forget, it smells disgusting as well when you open the can. It smells like perfume.
I don't think I've ever drunk it. And then there's a story later on in the book about why men don't buy cocktails because they're scared of getting served in a pineapple or something silly, or just even a silly glass with a parasol. So they just avoid it. And, you know, that's one of the things that we try to do, or that I encourage people do. You know, think about what are the concerns, what are the objections that your audience might have? What are they worried about? Like, you know, are they worried effectively about their painting effectively arriving in a pineapple? You know, is it going to be packaged properly? How are they going to hang it? What are the worries that they've got? If you give people more information and understanding about it so that those fade, like you, I don't think that's manipulative. I think that's helping people in a situation where they can make a decision which might get them the drink or the painting that they want. But what was quite funny about that story was then they did a test on drinks, and depending on what the drink was named, whether it was called vodka cocktail, vodka Red Bull cocktail, or fruit cocktail, they then gave different tasks to these guys to do. So one involved risk. It was something to do with blowing a balloon up until it popped, and then there being an award at the end. One was how long do you think it would be before you were safe to drive? So there were various different scenarios. And according to what they thought they'd drunk, they behaved completely differently. The drink was exactly the same. And none of us are immune to this. None of us are immune to this. So,
and I think this relates to...
It relates to things like painting titles, maybe?
Yeah, and it also, again, relates to pricing and positioning and branding. Like we all buy things. I think he makes this point in the book somewhere, that we buy things to say things about ourselves. Apart from necessities like food and heating, once we have those, anything else we buy is to communicate something about ourselves to other people. Our clothing, our furnishings, our home decor, it's all signaling to other humans. And so that's why people will buy Farrow and Ball paint rather than get the Farrow and Ball color mixed in a cheaper brand of paint, because then it's Farrow and Ball paint. And that's why we'll drink Red Bull or whatever. It's something about telling other people something about ourselves. So if we were
ourselves something about ourselves, I think it reinforces.
Yourself. But I think it's about signaling to other people too. But yeah, I think both. But so let's say then that there's an artist who really, I'm thinking of an example, actually. I went to a really average art show, a very local art show that I just happened to wander into the town hall when it was on. And when I say average, I just mean the things you would expect: normal landscapes, some quite bad paintings, nothing very great. But there was one artist, and I didn't particularly like her paintings. They were watercolor paintings of animals, but they were done with a certain style. But she had this big area, and she had all the paintings were framed beautifully, and she had graphics with her name, like you would have at an art fair where it was higher end art. And she was selling her paintings for really high prices. And you know what? She had loads of empty gaps in her space because she stood out from all those other people as someone.
Maybe average.
And this is a town. It was in a town that's a little bit, you know, everybody likes to think they're a little bit better than everyone else. And I'm not going to say the name of the town because I don't want to offend anyone. But it was in that town. And I could just see why she was doing well with those paintings, because it told you this person's above all the other people who were here. You should have this one. It costs £5,000. It's big and it costs £5,000. So I just think there's something in that for us.
I just think what's exciting about this is that it frees you from feeling like like you say, I've got to do things the way other people do them. I've got to do things the way it should be done. I've got to do things the proper way. We all have this. We all have this stuff because we've all grown up with it, learned it. That's how we learn things. I can't do anything that's different because, and I just think that it's a really nice book in terms of just releasing that little part of your brain that goes, huh, well, maybe, well, what if I, how could I? So I might say, okay, I'm not brave yet to totally, you know, reprice the way that I do my work. I'm not brave enough to do that yet, but I might be brave enough. And this is something I'm thinking about, of taking down all the paint. I've kind of half done it with the prints, to be honest, taking down all the paintings. So they're not available all the time on my website. You can't just buy one when you want to. You know, it's not there, like easy, available. They're gone. They're not there. And then you have a time gap when they're available to buy. Now, do I know that that would work better? Nope, don't have a clue. But reading a book like this makes me think, firstly, it makes me think, well, maybe there's a different way of doing things. You know, what are the ideas? What could be different? What is a little bit counterintuitive? Not because it's a marketing gimmick, but because I think it might work for me and the way things are released. And I don't know, for different reasons, what could be a different way of doing it? And I think it just gives you a little bit more, possibility that some of those things could actually work, but you don't know the outcome. The answer is you don't know the outcome until you try it. And that's a little bit like painting. You know, one of his rules here, a good guess which stands up to observation is still science. It's a lucky accident, but it's still science. You know, is this going to work or not? Don't know. Try it.
Yeah.
And I think often we're just looking for confidence to make some of those kind of decisions. And it might trigger some.
And I think what he makes the really good point is that what holds us back from that is thinking that other people's decisions are logical and sensible. And that therefore anything out of the ordinary, we just have to find some weird people to go along with us. But actually, he proves over and over again that our decisions are utterly not sensible. And he gave one example of why we brush our teeth. And he said, if you ask people, why do you brush your teeth? They'll say to avoid getting cavities and having to go to the dentist. And he said, that's rubbish, because if that was true, every time you ate a piece of chocolate, you would rush to clean your teeth. Every time you had some sugar, you'd go clean your teeth. You actually clean your teeth to not embarrass yourself in front of other people, to not have smelly breath, to not. So when you're going to go out on a date, you rush and brush your teeth.
Yeah, feeling fresh before you go to bed. The fact that it's minty, wasn't it? Didn't do anything.
Yeah, why is it minty?
Really pointless.
Yeah. Why is it minty? But we wouldn't like it if our toothpaste. I remember seeing some cinnamon toothpaste once and I was like, ooh.
Yeah, and some toothpaste. Kids' toothpaste is like strawberry flavor. It's like, what?
Yeah, toothpaste is minty. That's just the way it is. But that was just a silly little example that stuck in my mind that, yes, that is true. That's not why we do it. So often, if you ask people why they bought the car they bought, they'll say a sensible reason why. It gets good mileage. It's whatever. But it's probably more like it looks really sporty, or I really like the color, or it looks cute. Or, you know, there'll be other reasons. Or for a man, it might be because it's got a lot of horsepower and it just goes faster. Or my dad used to call, you know, when a car has a stripe on it, he used in the 70s, everybody wanted stripes. And he used to call it a go faster stripe. Yeah. Because people feel like, oh, I'll go faster if I've got a stripe. But that we don't make our decisions about things like buying cars and houses logically. Houses. I bought a house in America where the estate agent didn't want to show it to me. She showed me all the other houses and she was like, you won't like this one. It's up loads of flights of steps. It's not really got any garden. The rooms are a funny configuration, but I'll show it to you because we've looked at everything else. And we had quite a limited budget. So we were trying to get something great within a limited budget. I walked into that house. I was like, my house. This is my house. I didn't even go further than and we loved that house. Yes, it had all those weird things about it, but and when we came to sell it, we had like 40 viewings in the first few days. Everybody went away with no second viewing except one couple who went my house and bought it instantly. Like, that's how we make our decisions. And I could have told you it's because it's got big windows, or it's because all sorts of reasons I could have given you, but the real reason is something I couldn't even describe.
Yeah. So what do we take from this book then, other than the fact that everybody is nutty, us included? We are completely illogical beings. Don't try to find rhyme or reason in anything, because you'll just drive yourself mad. Is there anything that, so I've got this kind of slight idea brewing that will take time to settle, about possibly hiding the e-commerce on my website. Did it spring anything like that for you? Or do you think, I wonder if it's one of those books that you need to listen to once to understand it and then dip back and think, okay, right, is there any way that I can apply this a little bit more?
I think what it's brought up for me is really clearly this idea of, and I don't think he says this in so many words, but this idea of people will take you at whatever you present yourself to be. And you don't have to present yourself to be the thing that everybody else is presenting themselves to be. So I already know that it works to not have paintings for sale all the time, because I don't make enough paintings to always have things for sale. I know that that works. But where I'm thinking of applying it is thinking more about pricing. I mean, everybody listening, if you're going to take my course, take it this year, because I know it's underpriced. I know it's underpriced, but I've not increased, despite my coaches saying, if you increase the price, we'd get less people and it would still be the same income and we could handle it, you know, everybody. But I have this feeling of, I want as many people to access it as possible, and I don't want to price it at probably what it's worth. But is that my real reason, or is there some of this, people might not pay, and you know, people might not want to pay that much? So it's making me rethink that side of things. I know my logical brain keeps telling me there's a price limit on my paintings, there's a price limit on my courses, and yet, as he clearly demonstrates, people do not buy things on price. If we have to think, there was a restaurant in this.
I think people do use price as a justification not to do something, though.
Yes, but it's not the reason why they didn't do it. So I was just going to clarify, there's a restaurant near me that the chef once, apparently somebody rang up and said, how much is the taster menu? And he said, if you have to ask, you can't afford to come here, and hung up the phone. So I'm saying a serious point here. When at the times when I have been short of money, I haven't even considered taking courses or doing. So I'm not trying to make it sound like everyone's got money to fling around, especially now. I know they haven't. But for those people who have got disposable income to purchase a painting or a course, they might tell themselves their decision is based on price, but it isn't. It's something else that's the real reason, I think. Maybe the course isn't quite the right course. Maybe it's not quite the right time. I've been in that situation of scrimping and my pennies together to do something I can't really afford, because I just know I have to do it. I've also been in a situation where I've used money as the reason not to, because really it's not the right thing for me. To wrap up, we always finish with something that's inspired us. Mine is a bit lame this week, but I do have one. Alice is looking like she's not sure she has one. So do you want me to go ahead with mine, or do you think you have something?
You go with yours. I'll tell you what mine is. I'm not sure it's an inspired, but...
Mine's not very exciting, and it's not art related. But I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that I've been having some decorating done in the house and changing my bathroom and decorating my bedroom, and oh my goodness, last night it finally was finished and I moved into my newly decorated bedroom with my lovely paint colors. And it's just reminded me, we've been in this house 10 years, so when we moved in, we did it the way we wanted it. But 10 years later, things look tired and a bit tatty, and it's really time to rejuvenate things. But I hate mess. I hate disruption. I've been putting it off. So now the carpet isn't here, and that really needs replacing. But that'll be in a few weeks. It just reminded me that taking the time, in my case, somebody else's time, but if you do it yourself, taking the time to just spruce things up, I'm not talking about really dramatic things, has made a big difference to how I feel about my house. And now I'm looking at other bits of it that are a bit tatty and tired and thinking, oh, that's going to need fixing when I save up a bit more money.
You can do quite a lot with a rejuge.
What's a rejuge?
Tidying, clearing the clutter, having an empty. It's a kind of shifting energy thing, I think, often. Yeah. Move things around. There's a phrase, wasn't there? Shop your own home, which I quite like, because we just get used to seeing things that have been in the same place always. Move things around, change things from one room to the other. If you've got art, move it from one room to another.
I have to say as well, I mentioned to you last week, you can get paint colours mixed at B&Q. I always get my paint colours mixed at our local hardware store, and they've always been perfect, exactly what I asked for. But I went to B&Q to get something mixed. Oh my God. I opened the tin. It was supposed to be French grey, this kind of greeny French grey, and it was blue, like turquoise blue. And I went back and said, not happy. This is not the right colour. Oh, well, you can't return a custom colour. Well, it's not the custom colour that I asked for. And I also last month had painted this wall behind me with a custom colour from B&Q because our other place was shut. I bought the same colour again from my local hardware store, and it's so much nicer, the one from them. So if you're in the UK and you're thinking about getting paint colours mixed, don't go to B&Q, because I don't know what their system does. It's a scientific system. It should work perfectly. You put the numbers in the pigments, it mixes the pigments, but it doesn't work at B&Q. Anyway, I just wanted to correct that from what I said last week.
All right. Well, my kind of inspired, not inspired. Actually, my daughter was out last night at one of those theatre things where you all in a warehouse where you all move around and people have masks. And I don't understand how, like, there's no singular storyline. You pick bits up of the story by going into different rooms all the way over, way East London. So she was out for the evening. So my husband said, let's watch this film that you've been asking about for a while, which has got Olivia Colman in, and it's called The Lost Daughter on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
Have you watched it?
No, I've seen the trailer and thought I should watch it. But
yeah, so I've been thinking, let's watch that. I'm very glad we watched it. Even 5 minutes in, I said to him, I don't think Amy would have stuck with this. It was very slow. It's a very slow, gentle female film about caring for people, responsibilities, when it all gets too much. It's quite an interesting film. I'm not sure that I would massively recommend it, apart from to say she is just the most extraordinary actress. She's so good.
Yeah, she is.
You know, she can do so much just without even moving her face. I don't even know how she does it. So it was really good from that point of view. But I'm a little bit more inspired by the randomness of a phone call from a friend last week, which led to lunch and now is leading to a big two-family dinner happening. And, when things just kind of could be a big deal, shall we plan this? When are we going to do this? Random phone call, things happen. So question, inspiration is, what random thing have you been waiting to do that you've been putting off in the spirit of both Rory Sutherland and alchemy? What can we make happen? Random stuff. Next time a thought pops into your brain, just go and do it and see what happens.
Well, that'd be quite scary with some of the thoughts that pop into my brain.
Okay,
moving back to America. I've gone. I have so many random thoughts all the time.
Yeah.
On the note of Olivia Colman, weirdly enough, this week, for some reason, I stumbled upon her on YouTube. there's all sorts of clips of Olivia Colman on chat shows. She is the funniest woman. She's hilarious. And I ended up going down that rabbit hole of watching one video after another of Olivia Colman being funny and charming. So if anybody wants cheering up, go look up Olivia Colman on YouTube and you'll find all sorts.
Yeah, and partly funny because she says exactly what she thinks and not what people expect her to say.
Yes, exactly.
Goes back to what we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, do something unexpected then. Yeah, right, lovely. Right, lovely, nice chat this week. I should be telling people about Time to Shine, which is going to be available. So this is just 14 days to get you more in tune with how you want to show up. So it's perfect for if you're nervous, if you're not sure about how to show up online, what should you say? I don't really know how to get started with this. Or if you're a bit disillusioned, if you've lost your way, if you've been showing up on social media a certain way and it's not quite working for you, it's designed really to reconnect you with what's important and some real practical things that you can implement that are going to start make things work better for you. So that's Time to Shine. You can find a link through it from my website or go directly to soulrocketstudio.com/shine. And my website is alicesheridan.com. And yeah, Louise and I have both got things happening at the same time because you've got your course coming up, right?
Yeah, I was just thinking, we once got a review that said something like, this podcast is just these people selling themselves and their friends' stuff. Do you remember? Which I think was one of the most unfair reviews we've probably ever had, because I think we're one of the few podcasts without ads on it. We don't really do much selling of anything. But anyway.
I don't have anything about the membership in this, and the membership's closed most of the time.
So. Yeah. But we're about to do that because, yes, I do have my free course coming up. So this is once a year I do this. This year it starts on May the 20th. We do it for 8 days. It's just amazingly good fun. It's all about freeing yourself up. So Alice is talking about freeing yourself up, you know, to be visible and talk about your art. And mine is about freeing yourself up when you're making your art. It's good for anybody who's in transition, thinking about working in a different way. It's good for anybody who feels stuck, anybody who feels too tight and tense about their work. After 8 days, you will not feel like that anymore. So it's online, it's emails and videos. You don't have to be live, but we do some live chats as well. And those are recorded if you miss them. You need to really throw yourself into it's 8 days of fun. You can find that on my website at louisefletcherart.com and just click the For Artists tab and you'll see it listed there. Or it's on my homepage if you slightly scroll down a little bit. Absolutely no cost and no obligation to do anything else except come and have some fun. So hopefully see you there.
Lovely. See you next week then.
Bye.
Bye.
You know, a few weeks ago I said on here, oh, I just want a simple life. That's not really what's happening at the moment. I've somehow managed again to have, last year I had the book and the course, and this year I've got an exhibition and the course at the same time. And since it's my decision how I spend my time, this is all my fault. I have no one else to blame for the fact that they're coming at the same time.
Do you want that in outtakes?
I don't know, it wasn't very exciting. I'm just trying to think of something to say. Oh, I'm the host.
Well, we just looked at you.
I'm waiting for you to take charge. So, no, I'm not going to say so. I'm going to say...